Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, Congress passed a compromise that permanently prevents tax rates from rising on household income below $450,000 and also put deep spending cuts on ice until March. At the White House, President Obama hailed its passage.
Thanks to the votes of Democrats and Republicans in Congress, I will sign a law that raises taxes on the wealthiest 2% of Americans while preventing a middle-class tax hike that could have sent the economy back into recession and obviously had a severe impact on families all across America.
So do we have time to catch our breath, or should we start worrying all over again about the next fiscal cliff now slated for March? Joining us to help us with those, I guess, breathing exercises is NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin. Hi, Ken.
Good morning, Ann.
So do we have time to catch our breath?
Well, you know, it's funny. For all the high fives and the self-congratulations you saw on Capitol Hill after the passing of the fiscal cliff, you know that there's going to be another fight at the end of February when you know, we're going to have to vote to increase the debt limit. And President Obama says, I'm not compromising on that. There's no negotiations. And the Republicans said, if we're not getting any spending cuts, you're not going to get our cooperation. So for all the good feelings in Washington, and I think it's kind of forced good feelings because not many people are really happy with what happened. And, of course, a lot of people say that since everybody's unhappy, it must be a good deal. But the point is there are more battles to come, and very soon.
So everybody unhappy, any winners and losers?
Well, I guess a clear winner probably would be Joe Biden, the vice president. I mean, Biden has been the butt of jokes for the longest time, and much of it is deserved. But, you know, it wasn't working. Harry Reid wasn't working. It wasn't working with Harry Reid. Boehner and Obama were not getting along. And basically, the Republicans and Boehner ceded the responsibility to Mitch McConnell. And Mitch McConnell, who was not getting along with Reid, said, look, you know, Joe, I know Joe Biden pretty well. And, you know, while Joe Biden is not, you know, flirting with pretty women, he can do a good job. So apparently he did do a good job. And they feel that he came out on top. And I don't even think it's grudging respect from the Republicans. I think the Republicans really appreciated the work he did, but not all Republicans, mm-hmm. because if you look at what's going on with Mitch McConnell, there's a new ad in Kentucky. He's up for re-election next year. Conservatives are putting up full-page ads in some Kentucky newspapers saying that he's sold out. Even John Boehner, who, when we've said this on your, I said this on your show for ages, he always has this battle trying to, on the one hand, trying to get things done and accomplish some goals, and two, trying to keep his unruly Tea Party conservatives in line. I mean, Boehner got more, even though it's only 12 Republicans who didn't vote for him. That's more than any other Republican, than any other speaker, and I think perhaps in history, in the vote for speaker.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. If you have a question or comment for Ken, we welcome them. 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You know, when I listen to you talk about them, when I listen to you talk about them, Ken, it sounds like you want to send them all down to the principal's office. And I was wondering, how much does it come down to personalities when it comes to stuff like this?
You know, I don't think it's so much personalities because I think people genuinely, Republicans genuinely like John Boehner. He is a likable guy. I don't think they fear him like they would fear, you know, some of the tough speakers of the past. But they like him. They just feel that he's just doesn't have the backbone. But he feels that, look, sure, I can go along with the Tea Party and I can go along with, you know, voting against all these deals. And I could drive over the cliff and take the economy with me along with you. But that's not what I want to do. So I don't even think it's personalities. I think it's really about the fact is that it is about ideology. And a lot of these Tea Party folks who were elected in 2010 and those who got reelected in 2012 said, well, the reason we were elected and reelected is because we're standing on principle and not compromise. And compromise is a word they hate to use.
You included in your blog a list of all the new members of Congress. And I was wondering, just in general, did the Tea Party, was it strengthened in the last election or stay the same or what?
Well, considering the fact that the Republicans picked up 63, a net gain of 63 seats in 2010, and the Republicans only lost 8 seats, total, a net loss of 8 in 2012. That's not bad. Now, of course, a lot of this has to do with redistricting and the fact that Republicans drew a lot of the districts, as you saw in Ohio and other states. But at the same time, losing 8 seats is not that terrible, given the fact that, you know, everybody says, oh, the Tea Party is destroying the Republican Party. There were some major people who, you know, did go down. Alan West in Florida is a major example. Joe Walsh in Illinois, a big Tea Party guy, was beaten. Michelle Bachmann barely survived a reelection, and she's the chair of the Tea Party caucus in Congress. So did they get a hit? Yeah, but you know something? I still think that a lot of them would rather lose on principle than win for the sake of winning. And so if, you know, I think they'd rather have, you know, I think they'd rather have a conservative Republican go down to defeat than a moderate so-called rhino, you know, Republican in name only Republican getting reelected, like a Dick Lugar or somebody like that.
Which is John Boehner's problem, that these guys and gals have no interest in, making him like them. They're more interested in following through on the promises they made in the campaign.
Well, I mean, in some ways, you could give the Tea Party folks, you should respect that, because if you make a promise you want to keep with it, keep to it. And, you know, there's some people who criticize former President Bush as being incapable of changing his mind. And there are some people on the left who fault President Obama, who does change his mind and give up some core positions in order to get a deal. So both sides, both folks on either side of the ideological aisle are not happy with either somebody who doesn't bend or somebody who is willing to compromise. Nobody's ever happy. I mean, and really, are you ever happy? I listen to your show a lot. You never sound happy.
I know. I laugh, but inside I'm crying. So John Boehner was reelected Speaker of the House. Number one, why does he want to be Speaker of the House? Number two, you wrote about that in your blog and wondered what was going on in his mind.
I mean, why does anybody want to be President of the United
States?
Why does anybody want to be Mayor of New York? But the thought of Boehner, I mean, look, he is a legislator at heart, and he's gone through tough times. I mean, he was first elected, I guess, 1990, and, you know, he was moving up, and then during the Gingrich years, he was pushed out, then he came back again. I mean, he's had his ups and downs, and you wonder, why do you want to be pilloried left and right? But and he's not an ambitious guy. I mean, unlike some people who said that, well, you know, maybe this is a stepping stone to higher office. But look, Speaker of the House is pretty high up there. I think he just really believes and wants to get things done. But is he a leader? Is he a visionary? He's not. I mean, he's more of a technocrat. And I was going to say he's more of a numbers cruncher. But, of course, had he been a good numbers cruncher, he wouldn't have offered that plan B on stuff and then realized, oh, my goodness, I don't have the votes to even put it on the floor.
Yeah, well, it makes that does make one wonder, what was he thinking?
Well, I don't know.
We don't know.
I don't know. We had Steve LaTourette, the former congressman from, I guess, the Cleveland suburbs on Talk of the Nation yesterday. And he said, you know, he said, you wonder why they really, really want this, why he really, really wants it. But ultimately, he just, you know, he thinks that the Republican Party has something important to say. And just trying to get them on the same page is just so difficult.
If you want to talk with Ken Rudin, 614-292-8513. Kenny in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I think if we don't come to negotiations over the debt ceiling, the Democrats will be blamed, and rightly so. Mitch McConnell is a negotiator. He said during the other negotiations over the financial cliff, he needed someone to negotiate with. Finally, they got him by to negotiate. So I believe in the House could have blocked that proposal. They didn't, even though they didn't take with amendments, they didn't do it. So I believe you can negotiate with Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. You can negotiate with him. He's a negotiator. Boehner, for political reasons, switches to the Senate, which turned out to be the right move on his part. He said, go through the Senate. And that's where negotiation took place, and the House went along with it. So I believe if they can't negotiate, it's not the Republicans' fault. It's not the Tea Party's fault. It's the Democrats' fault. And I believe the Democrats will be held responsible for that the next election. And the Democrats shouldn't be expect to get 70% Hispanic vote, especially if they run Bush. They shouldn't expect to get 70% Hispanic vote like it did at last election. And it's going to be a different election.
Ken Rudin, what do you make of what Kenny said?
Well, I mean, anybody with the name Kenny, I agree with. I mean, look, first of all, I mean, it's so impossible to predict the next election. Just for example, in 2008, Obama wins, McCain loses, the Republicans are finished forever, the Democrats will hold Congress forever, and then 2 years later, the Republicans have a huge, huge win. So it's hard to predict what's going to happen in 2 years. I do agree with Kenny in the sense that sending the negotiation and the deal to the Senate was absolutely the right way, because there was more, whatever you think of Mitch McConnell, he is a canny a legislator willing to compromise. The problem is, and this is what Obama said. He said, look, what the debt ceiling is all about is this is the stuff that we agreed to pay, and this is the bills that have come due. And, I mean, it's our responsibility to pay our bills. I mean, after all, we, meaning the Congress, we agreed to this stuff, so how could you not pay for it? But on the other hand, McConnell knows that if Obama wants to get other things done in his second term, and he obviously has a far bigger – I mean, not bigger than healthcare, but he certainly has a tremendous big agenda in his second term. He's going to need Republican support. And for Obama to say, I'm not negotiating one bit on debt ceiling, I mean, McConnell could say, you know, you want to play that game? We can play that game, too. So I don't know if the Democrats will get blamed for it. I just know that right now, I mean, there was a poll that came out this week from Public Policy Polling about, I mean, let me tell you, this is what it says. It says, Congress is now less popular than root canals, NFL replacement referees, head lice, the rock band Nickelback, whatever that is, colonoscopies, carnies, traffic jams, cockroaches, Donald Trump, France, Genghis Khan, used car salesmen, and Brussels sprouts. That's pretty difficult. So I kind of suspect that if we're back to a here we go again, I think it'll be a pox on both parties, and I think both parties will suffer. I love that list, by the way.
Wow.
It didn't mention our names, Ann. I just checked.
It didn't say anything about journalists?
No. And if it did, I wouldn't read that.
Right. My guest is Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. If you have a question or comment for Ken, he's going to be with us for the whole hour. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Check out our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point from Beijing, we're joined by China's most famous living artist and outspoken social critic, Ai Weiwei. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 30 degrees with partly sunny skies today and a high of 46. Some rain showers moving in this evening and rain likely overnight, a low of 43 degrees. Showers, possibly a thunderstorm on Friday, but mild temperatures, a high near 60. Support comes from the Columbus Dance Theater, presenting the world premiere of Cleopatra with support from PNC Arts Alive, a performance that weaves dance, theater, music, and video on stage to bring this historical figure to life. Three shows, January 18th and 19th at the Lincoln Theater. Details at columbusdancetheater.com. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin. If you have a question, comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Matt that kind of follows up on what we were talking about a few minutes ago, Ken. He writes, since the House is so unwilling to compromise, the White House had to negotiate with Senate Republicans for the fiscal cliff compromise. Is this going to be the new precedent for pushing through legislation, with the Senate doing negotiations and the House just having to vote on it?
Well, it could be. I mean, of course, that I think that was the lesson that Boehner got. He Look, he hated the fact that the fiscal cliff legislation came back to the House and it was passed with Democratic votes. So he doesn't want that to happen at all. But you know, I mean, he also got, you know, the fact is that, more and more conservatives said, look, you know, you've got to take more of a leadership role. I suspect that, Boehner will not be as pliant as he was in the past, or at least during the fiscal cliff stuff, and maybe, you know, have either a stronger backbone or be, you know, be more assertive in the negotiations. But who knows? Oh, by the way, in that poll I said before,
yeah.
I also found out, but the good news, Congress beat out telemarketers John Edwards, the Kardashians, lobbyists, North Korea, the Ebola virus, Lindsay Lohan, Fidel Castro, playground bullies, meth labs, communism, and gonorrhea. So there is some good news for Congress.
That's good news. And the good news is, and here's Robert from Hilliard wants to ask. Hi, Robert, as a follow-up. Welcome.
Yeah, Ken actually stole my laugh because I couldn't believe that when that scrolled across my TV. The Congress was actually less popular than root canals and colonoscopies.
Yeah. And even semi-colonoscopies, which is amazing.
I've had one of those two. I won't say which one. I agree with the poll. Here's what I want to know.
Let's hope you didn't have cockroaches.
Here's what I want to know. You know these people. I mean, do you talk to them? I'm sure you do if you're the political junkie. Do they get it? Do they we have poll after poll for 2-3 years now where it says these things. Do they understand? Because we out here in the field, I think probably Ann also, they keep doing it over and over, and it's like Groundhog Day up there, you know, where they just keep having these silly battles and these insignificant consequences. And do they get it?
Well, they're not insignificant consequences, but the real question, as you say, is do they get it? And I don't know. I mean, half of them, you know, most of them are true believers who say, look, this is why we're elected. I'd rather lose than compromise on my principles. Other Republicans are saying, if I just go along with it, if I say, well, maybe this is the right thing for the country, they know that they have to keep looking over their shoulder because there's going to be a right-wing, you know, Tea Party challenge in the primary in 2014 or the next election. I mean, Dick Lugar in Indiana lost for a lot of reasons. It's not just because he was moderate or liberal or pro-Obama or anything, but the point is he got clobbered in the Tea Party in the primary, and of course the Republicans lost the seat. But there are other Republicans out there who just you know, every time they're talking about, well, I'll do a, you know, I'll co-sponsor a piece of legislation with a Democrat. They know that the phones will be ringing off the hook. So the question is whether the Tea Party will be as effective in 2014 as they certainly were in 2010, less so in 2012. But you know, lawmakers are worried, and the last thing you want, well, there are two things that are the last things you want. You don't want a Congress that refuses to budge and refuses to compromise. And the second part is you don't want a Congress that is constantly looking at Election Day and the date of the primary and not worrying about what's best for the country. So that's a discouraging prognosis right there, but I think it's accurate.
Yeah, it just seems like we're at a standstill, and it's just disgusting. So thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you, Robert. Ken Rudin, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said that the president has to really work hard to get the public behind him on the debt ceiling and gun control issues. What do you think it'll take to get the public behind him?
Well, you know, the gun issues are always is a fascinating thing because, you know, after the tragedy of Newtown, just like after the tragedy in Aurora, just like the tragedy in Columbine, there was tremendous outrage in the country. We must do something. We must, you know, outlaw assault weapons. We must do all these things. And then that momentum seems to fade. We just had a Democrat, Heidi Heitkamp, a senator who was just elected North Dakota. And, of course, Democrats were thrilled to death that, you know, thrilled that she won that election. She wasn't supposed to. And then one of the first things she said last week was, we got to stop the government from having these evil anti-gun laws or something like that. And, mm-hmm. and I mean, it just, you know, people just were baffled. And the point is, you know, and you see Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, in his State of the State address yesterday, had this big anti-gun part of his program, and I mean, some people are talking about confiscation. But if you look at all the murders in New York in 2011, which I think is the last most recent year we have figures for, only five of them were committed by rifles or assault weapons. So you think something has to be done, but, and you know, the NRA says, well, we should put an armed guard in front of every school. Well, Aurora, Colorado was a movie theater. Do you put an armed guard in front of every movie theater? Gabby Givers was shot at a shopping center. Do you put a guard at every shopping center? So there's got to be an answer, but Congress is the one that's going to do it, and Congress seems no closer to any kind of a deal than they did before the latest tragedy.
And Gabby Giffords, of course, former representative from the state of Arizona, she started a new organization with her husband, and it kind of reminded me of the Brady.
I thought the same thing. The first thing I thought of, too, are they duplicating efforts? And
right.
In some sense, they are. Of course, Gabby Giffords and her husband, Mark Kelly, came out with this thing on the second anniversary of her shooting, which, of course, was very poignant. And they said, look, we are still pro-Second Amendment. We still have guns in our home locked up, but they have guns as well. And that part got kind of but the point is there's still a lot of mental health screening that needs to be done. There has to be more ways of tracking down, you know, searching to find out the past, the history of those who buy it. And I don't know why the NRA would even object to that, because when it's not talking about confiscation of guns, it's not talking about limiting guns, it's just talking about, you know, identity checks and the safety checks. And I mean, that's at the minimum, why not have that? And why do you need a magazine that could shoot off 50 rounds? I mean, you could, because the deer are very clever. I mean, it's obviously about killing, and sometimes people have to say, okay, stop. Maybe it's time to stop. I'm sorry. I usually don't go off on rants like this, but just guns and just the thought of children and the caskets of 6-year-old children, to me, it's unfathomable.
What do you think the discussion will be elevated by this latest tragedy? Do you think that there really is going to be some conversation in the Congress about this, or is it going to be a bunch of bills introduced or a package of bills introduced and, you know, they get a few hearings, but it pretty much dies?
I don't know the answer to that. You know, mm-hmm. The last vote on assault weapons ban came in 2004, 10 years after the 94, you know, assault weapons ban was about to expire. There's been no vote in the Senate since 2004. Today, Vice President Biden is meeting with a bunch of pro-gun and pro-sportsman groups like the NRA, but also like groups like Walmart, which sells more guns than anywhere else in the country. So I hope there's not grandstanding after it, but I almost wonder that when thinking of Andrew Cuomo's State of the State message yesterday, it may have to come down to the state stuff, because even, you know, the pro-gun Democrats who were very, you know, torn after what happened in Newtown, mm-hmm. like people like Joe Manchin in West Virginia, all the hemming and hawing that you heard from them right after the shooting, that's gone. You don't hear that anymore.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin. If you have a question for him, comment 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, when it comes to gun control, it seems like back in the day, you know, maybe during the Reagan administration and around that time, a lot more likelihood of getting something through. Now, given the makeup of the Congress, it would suggest that it's never been less likely, despite the carnage in Connecticut.
Well, I mean, you could say it's a Republican House. But look, Harry Reid, the Democratic leader in the Senate, has been fighting gun control for years. Tom Daschle, the previous Democratic leader, was never a fan of gun control. And as I said, you know, these new Democrats who came in, like Heidi Heitkamp, in these rural areas, you know, I mean, they're saying, you know, we're not going to change the law.
Right. But, well, I guess that's what I mean, is not the makeup necessarily on, you know,
Democrats or Republicans.
Right. Yeah, but yeah. Just overall the attitudes.
Well, I keep thinking that something is going to have to change, like 9/11 had to change something for something to happen. And, you know, like Comity and Congress, and that didn't happen. Look, how much worse can it get for something mm-hmm. to happen? And that's why I kind of think that, you know, look, it's either the NRA is so powerful or the sportsmen groups are so fearful. But either way, I don't see Congress doing much more, certainly not an assault weapons ban. That's not even in the cards. And we'll see if once again this commission that Joe Biden is heading up becomes one of those typical Washington commissions that everybody yak, and then suddenly then nobody hears from them again.
Another blue ribbon panel.
Yeah, right.
Here we have Mark from Columbus wants to talk about the next presidential election. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks, Ann, and thanks, Ken. First of all, let me offer a comment on the congressional. I love the discussion about how do we get Congress to, you know, to do what we want or to act rationally, and it reminds me of the Pogo comic strip that at one point said, we have met the enemy and they as us.
Yep.
We're the folks who elect members of the House, members of the Senate, and we continue to think that our congressperson is really good, but everyone else is worthless.
Right.
It's really up to us. My question, Ken, and I love listening to you, and I know you don't like to prognosticate, but I'll ask you to do it anyway, is to, at this point, handicap where the Republicans go for the next presidential race, and in particular, where Chris Christie stands right now. Because right now, he's everybody's favorite Republican because he took time to talk to a Democrat. Where do you see this going right now?
Well, you know, regarding Chris Christie, the hate mail he got and the vitriol I saw on the internet after his embrace of President Obama, to me, was just so short-sighted. It was not about trying to sabotage Mitt Romney. It was about somebody who's coming into New Jersey, which was devastated by Hurricane Sandy. So it's interesting, you know, prior to Hurricane Sandy, just like prior to 9/11, George W. Bush's numbers were very lukewarm. Christie was in big trouble, we thought, prior to Sandy. But now people like Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, says, I'm not running for governor. Every poll that comes out shows Christie head and shoulders above any possible Democrat. Of course, the election is this year. But it's one thing to be very popular at home in a blue state like New Jersey. And Chris Christie, while he's an in-your-face Republican, he loves to taunt the unions. He loves to taunt the Democrats. And that's exactly why they make him keynote speaker. I'm not sure if his views on many social issues are not dye-in-the-wool conservative. But going beyond Chris Christie, I mean, in answer to your question, Mitt Romney may be the last of his kind that the Republicans will ever nominate. If you look at the demographics in the country, if you look at the changing, I mean this not as a pun, of course, but the color of the country is different. The people are different. To stand up at a debate and say the answer is self deportation or talking about illegals, I mean that is so offensive. And the fact that the party didn't know it, or many of the leaders of the party, I mean, Santorum and Romney and Perry were fighting over who was going to build a bigger fence, which was so crazy. But so that leads me to that four-letter word that a lot of people don't like to talk about, and that's Bush. And Jeb Bush, from the beginning, I mean, not just because his wife is Latino, not just because his kids are Hispanic and all that stuff, but he knows that the way to the future is not to ignore the growing population of the country and to dismiss them as just a special interest group. We saw Romney before the election and even after the election talking about these entitled people. Well, they're Americans. You know, they're Americans. They're not entitled people. They're entitled just like white people and green people. And Bush seems to get it. And I kind of think that with his focus on education, with his focus on the multicultural, growing multicultural nature of this country, Bush would make sense. And you know, I said this years and years ago, but had he not lost when he ran for governor of Florida in 1994, had he not lost that election, it would have been Jeb Bush and not George W. Bush who the Republicans put up in 2000, because the word from the beginning was Jeb Bush was the one that, well, let's put it this way, was the better candidate. And I don't know if it's too soon to talk about Bush as the name Bush as a presidential candidate. But I think he would be, you know, he's exactly in many ways what the Republican Party has completely left, you know, behind in the recent years.
Well, could Jeb or George W. make it through a Republican primary?
I think Jeb can. I think really Jeb really understands what's wrong with the country. And I think most Republicans, especially after watching the numbers that Romney got with Latinos, with women, with African-Americans, I think knowing that, it says even if it's cynical, even if it's like, well, we've got to win. We've got to get these voters back. And maybe Jeb Bush, because he has a Spanish accent, can do it. That's not the best reason. That's not the most laudable reason to back Bush. But I think Jeb Bush would have, I mean, who are they going to run against? You know, they're going to run against, you know, some Alan West, ultra-conservative Tea Party that will get, you know, your 35%. And look, who knows? I mean, you know, the day of the New Hampshire primary in 2008, we were convinced Barack Obama was going to win it. A month before that, I was convinced Hillary Clinton would be the nominee. And so, you know, if I can't get something the week of the election or the month of, going 3 years, 4 years down the road is foolhardy. But the Bush, what Bush stands for and what Bush believes in is something I think that the Republican Party needs to pay attention to.
Just turning our sights back to the gun control issue briefly, Mark in Whitehall, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hi, Mark.
Yes, Ken, when you made a comment about the firearms, the control, you know, after the shooting and the school shooting, I got four children myself. I got an eight-year-old, and I'm a gun owner. And, you know, I'm thinking, yeah, you definitely have to do something. You know, the mental issues, that's a big thing. You have to control the firearms. I have no control about that or problem with that. You buy a firearm, you should register it. It's like an automobile. But there's a lot of people out there have that conspiracy theory. You know, once you grant one,
it leads to confiscation.
The slippery slope.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you lost me when you said about, you know, no one needs a magazine that holds 10 rounds to shoot a deer and all that. You know, the Second Amendment, not about hunting. It's not about target shooting. You know, it's been bickered back and forth about what a well-regulated militia is. No, it's well-regulated militia to, you know, to stop tyranny, whether it's your government or the king's government. When you start, you know, saying things about, you know, you can still hunt and all that, that's where you lose a lot of people. I'm a firearms collector. I don't hunt. I don't target shoot. I like to collect weapons. I like the way they made, you know, high quality firearms are like pieces of art. They actually are. They're just like tools, like a butcher knife or a saw. You know, you have to take precautions. We had an editorial a couple of days ago in the Plymouth Dispatch. A guy had said that, you know, you can have a voucher program if you pay minimal amount to these people with assault rifles. These assault rifles are like anywhere from $700 to, you know, $1,400. So someone's not going to turn it in for a $50 Best Buy card. And then it said that after you get that, if people don't turn them in, you have good citizens turn these in and get a bounty for turning your neighbors in. See, right there, you just lost, you know, all the support, you know.
Ken?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, look, I understand the slippery slope argument. I understand the fears. I do know that after Newtown and after tragedies like that, the people who applied for gun licenses like quadrupled. I mean, people just felt that if the government is going to just, you know, and people have talked about confiscation. I think Andrew Cuomo mentioned something like that. So it's not the kind of thing that's out of mind. It just, and I understand what you're talking about collectors and guns, and we saw this terrible multi killings in China not too long ago with a knife. So are we going to regulate knives? But at the minimum, I think there should be an automated system where you can check the records of people who are applying for licenses. We should the 7-day waiting period or the 14-day waiting period, and the problem with even if about mental illness, the person who committed those horrific murders in Newtown, the guns were his mother's.
Mm-hmm.
So checking, making mental health adjustments there wouldn't have changed that either. I mean, I don't know what the answer is. And I agree with you in the sense that I don't want to just say, we got to do something, so let's do anything because we can't have this again. But to me, the answer to gun violence, in my mind, is not more guns. But as far as punitive measures, I don't think that that's the answer either. And I agree with you. I mean, there are people who collect guns, and there are people who like to shoot target practice and things like that. I don't know what the answer is, mm-hmm. and I don't think the pro-gun Democrats know what the answer is either. Otherwise, they would have suggested something.
Mark, thanks for your call. Mark, we have to go to a break right now. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for the call. Take care.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back.
Join 89.7 NPR News for our new weekend lineup. Saturdays at noon, Radiolab explores the mystery of science and the magic of real life. At 2 p.m., the Moth Radio Hour features wonderful storytelling. And at 3, the TED Radio Hour stimulates the imagination. Listen Saturdays on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to watch Columbus on the Record Friday night at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. This week, News Director Mike Thompson and his panel provide an in-depth analysis of several topics, including Ted Strickland's decision not to seek a rematch with Governor John Kasich. Tune in for Columbus on the Record tomorrow night at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. 30 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly sunny skies today, a high of 46. Rain moving in after 5 o'clock this evening, and rain likely tonight, a low of 43. Showers and maybe a thunderstorm on Friday, and a high of 60 degrees. WOSU is supported by the McCoy Center for the Arts. National Geographic tornado hunter Tim Samaras will detail his harrowing job with scientific tidbits and footage from his adventures in the field. A show for all ages, Sunday, January 13th, at the McCoy Center in New Albany. More at mccoycenter.org. And All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Nancy, kind of an upbeat email, Ken. She just wanted to say how much she enjoyed Ken Rudin and Neil Conan when they came to Columbus last fall. Hope the political junkie makes another trip to Central Ohio. Will you be back in Columbus?
Well, we always come back. We always come back the October right before the midterm election. But unfortunately, that looks like not until October 2014. And I'm going to be, you know, much, much older by then.
What are you saying?
Well, it's...
We don't even want to talk about
it. No, I don't like that.
I don't like to talk about that either. No. David in Delaware. I've been waiting patiently. Hi, David. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. My question actually is morphed during the waiting time. Went on to presidential election, and my question is Kasich in 2016?
For president?
Yeah.
Well... of course, you remember, you know, back in 1999, he was talking about running for president, and I even have my Kasich for president buttons and T-shirt. I still have them. I don't know. I mean, of course, you know, we saw the news that Ted Strickland said he won't take him on. I did notice that Kasich's numbers in Ohio have risen in the past couple of weeks or months. That's a good question. He isn't on the top of my list, but I mean, he and there are a lot of Midwest Republicans. Scott Walker in Wisconsin also been mentioned. He's somebody to look at. He's ambitious, he's smart, and of course, he'll be term limited in 2020. So, 2018, I mean. 2018.
Right.
So, I mean, maybe he's looking at it, but of course, it depends on this. You know, as with Chris Christie, as we said this a while ago, he's got to get through a re-election first, there's going to be no shortage. You know, somebody's just mentioned that aside from Hillary Clinton, it seems like the Democrats don't have much of a bench. I mean, they're talking about Joe Biden, and they're talking about maybe Andrew Cuomo and maybe Martin O'Malley of Maryland, but there seems to be a lot of smart, energetic, and exciting Republicans looking at 2016, which it's hard to compare that to Mitt Romney. I mean, it's easy to jump on, pile on Mitt Romney right now, but there were so many things wrong with that candidacy from the beginning, from the fact that he has so many different positions on so many different issues, and I think it's unusual to see a Republican nominee or any presidential nominee just completely forgotten so quickly.
David, thanks for your call.
What?
I said thanks for your call.
Thanks.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Charlie, asks, what are your thoughts about term limits for the House and the Senate? With Congress on a two-year time cycle, that's only as far ahead as they think. Meanwhile, other countries that we are now competing with, such as China, have 5, 10, and 15-year plans with clearly outlined goals. We would never be able to have ambitious plans for new development with a two-year outlook. So why aren't more people talking about term limits so that politicians don't have to be concerned about primary challenges? Do you think term limits would create more of a problem on that score, Ken? Or?
Well, I've never been a fan of term limits. Mm-hmm. I always feel you should not take away the decision from the American voters. If you're tired of somebody, you want somebody out, just vote them out. Now, it's easy for me to say that because, of course, it's because we know that incumbents have so much money that, and it's so much more difficult for challengers to raise that money. So incumbents always have that advantage. But we also know that a lot of people are for term limits until they get into office. And then once they're in the office, they say, wait a second, I don't want to go anytime soon. Some people do, but some people say, uh-uh. And then a lot of times, voters or pallbearers have to just carry them out.
Okay, so let's turn to the new cabinet or the cabinet nominees or lack thereof in some cases. What do you make of that? I'm kind of interested in the idea that Senate Republicans are more likely to confirm John Kerry, Democrat from Massachusetts, for Secretary of State than Chuck Hagel, Republican ex-senator from Nebraska.
That's a whole fascinating story. Part of it is, of course, that the Republicans got what they wanted with Secretary of State because they got Susan Rice to back down. And perhaps maybe Obama was so humbled and humiliated by the Susan Rice trial balloon that he's certainly not going to back down with Chuck Hagel. And a lot of people saying Chuck Hagel is anti-Semitic because he talked about the Jewish lobby. They're saying that he's anti-gay because he criticized James Hormel, Clinton's ambassador to Luxembourg years ago, when he called him aggressively gay and things like that. I really think it's more about personality. And just a lot of Republicans don't like Chuck Hagel. Chuck Hagel is the kind of guy who he's very smart. He's a amazingly decorated Vietnam War veteran. He is a Republican, and obviously Barack Obama would love to have another Republican in the cabinet. But he's been a prickly kind of guy. He was not warmly received by many of his Republicans. He was one of the loudest critics of the Iraq War and the Iraq surge during the Bush administration. I'm not saying that position was wrong, but it wasn't always popular with Republicans. He endorsed Barack Obama over John McCain in 2008. People are not going to forget that too. So when you add all these things, when you have the Jewish groups talking about the Israeli lobby, and he was opposed to sanctions on Hamas and Hezbollah. He said that sanctions against Iran would not work. And of course, that's not Republican. I mean, Republican views; those are certainly not Republican policy views today. So, a combination of all these things. Will Hagel be defeated? Who knows? I don't think so. But I think it's deep-seated opposition. And it's not just, as a lot of Democrats say, it's not just, we want to give Obama a tough time. And it's far more personal than that. And it's very personal with Chuck Hagel. Whereas John Kerry, it's interesting. I mean, the Republicans said smooth sailing. Now it's possible the Republicans would like smooth sailing for John Kerry to open up a Senate seat and they could bring back Scott Brown. But I kind of think it's really about the fact that, okay, we got what we wanted with State. We got rid of Susan Rice. We never liked Susan Rice. And now we're going to do what we can to defeat Chuck Hagel.
If you want to talk with Ken Rudin, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org.
You know, I mentioned, by the way, I mentioned this on the show, that because of the opposition from Jewish groups, I thought it's possible that Hegel could get confirmed, but not bar mitzvahed. I just thought I'd point that out to the American people.
There are limits.
Yes, there are. Not with me, but they should be.
You know, there was a letter to the editor in the paper today. There have been I've seen other comments around and chit-chat about it. And, of course, the second inauguration is never as, you know, whoop-de-doo as the first anyway. And of course, there aren't very many things that will top 4 years ago anyway. But what are the politics of that second inauguration, especially with all of the economic issues and that sort of thing?
You know, it's interesting. There are a lot of things that Obama's played. First of all, there's a lot of discussion about how he intends to or might consider going over the heads of Congress, to get things done, and that includes gun laws and things like
executive
action. And I know Biden alluded to that the other day. So there is a possibility that while a lot of progressive Democrats said that Obama was too narrowly focused and too had a short list. Of course, healthcare is an enormous accomplishment, but I have a feeling there's a lot of things like guns, like immigration, like debt ceiling, like, you know, taxes and things like that, that he may be less hesitant to be talking about. And of course, you start that with the inauguration, and you started with the State of the Union address. But you're absolutely right. 4 years ago, I mean, living in this city and just getting on the metro in the morning and just watching everybody decked to the heels, the most gorgeous furs and dresses and suits and little kids. It was very, very, it was exciting. And this is not a political statement. This is just an observation about, you know, the word hope has been so discredited and discarded over the past 4 years. But I will tell you, on January 20th, 2009, hope was a big word. I don't see it as much today.
Did you go to the inauguration?
I didn't. We were where I was working.
Yep.
But of course, I saw the lines of people walking past, because we're only about 10 blocks from the Capitol, NPR is. And so out looking out the window, there was just, you know, some, you know, lots and lots of parades, and not so much parades, but just swarms of people walking. And it was just very, very exciting, very moving.
I was talking to somebody who went to it 4 years ago, would like to go to it again, May. Of course, there's hotel rooms available now, whereas 4 years ago there weren't, so they can be more flexible. But they said if they had to wait in line for, 7 or 8 hours? Or not in line, in a corral.
Yeah, it's also, don't forget, it's also Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday.
Right.
And so there would be fewer people worried about taking off from work. So I don't expect more people to be there, but there's certainly an opportunity for more people to be there because of the national holiday.
Steve in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi there. I haven't listened to the whole show, but do you think that the Tea Party is losing its grip on the Republican Party?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of people have been saying that the Tea Party is dead and that the Tea Party is losing. Look, the Tea Party is not the Republican Party. The Tea Party doesn't get excited if they win control of the Congress or they win a certain race. They're excited when their candidate, their either fiscally or socially or whatever kind of conservative, is elected. And even if they beat a Republican in the process, they're happy. So a lot of people said that, well, the fiscal cliff deal shows the decline of the Tea Party, but I'm not convinced of it. I mean, we saw a lot of Republicans, not a lot, but a sizable number of Republicans. You and I were talking about Ted Yoho before the show.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of those people, a Tea Party favorite, who came out of nowhere and beat this conservative Republican of Florida with completely surprise. So they still know what they want. They still have their target list. Again, if this was the Tea Party was designed to get a Republican majority in Congress, then maybe they are not as effective. But if they have their point of view and they insist on nominating the candidates who adhere to their philosophy, I don't see them diminishing their clout. Look, it's easy to be very powerful in 2010 when the Congress is Democratic, but I found that they're just as willing to go after Republicans as they are as going after Democrats.
Well, you mentioned this Yoho guy.
Yeah.
And there's an article in this month's Atlantic Monthly about him. And it just makes the Tea Party look like a bunch of bigots.
Well, how so?
There's a, as Yoho is campaigning, one of the people says, "Oh, I thought you were a Jap." That's a quote from the article. And Yoho then, after that, makes sure that his picture is on his campaign literature so that people don't think he's a Jap.
Well, look,
that term is enough.
There will always be abhorrent thought and language and behavior, and you'll get that from everybody. You do see it more from the right. I do know that when a lot of members, several black members of Congress, when they came out of voting for Obamacare, they were spat upon, and you know, the media will always pick up, you know, either the crazy signs in a rally or the spitting. And I'm not diminishing that for a second, but I mean, all I can say is that there are with many movements, but especially with the Tea Party, there are fringe characters who, even if you think that what the Tea Party stands for is right, you know, smaller government, let's pare down the debt, there are ideological folks out there who are just beyond the pale. I mean, I don't know how else to say it.
We are of a country of many stripes. Thank you, Steve. Real quick, Paul and Bexley, you're on the air. We just have about a minute left.
Yeah, a quick question about the filibuster. When did they change from the old style of having to stand up and talk and instead of this blockage the way the Republicans have been doing it? And does it look like there's going to be any changes?
I don't know. There are more people talking about changes than ever before. I mean, everybody's thinking of Jimmy Stewart standing and holding up the Senate, or Strom Thurmond filibustering against civil rights bills for 22 hours. I don't know when it's going to happen, but Mitch McConnell says if the Democrats curtail the use of the filibuster, they'll regret it. I mean, they talk about the nuclear option. More and more Democrats want to change it. I don't know if it's going to happen.
Ken Rudin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann.
Pleasure as always. Ken Rudin, NPR's political junkie. Thanks for all of your calls and emails, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.